Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. We have NFL Week 13, Florida State getting absolutely hosed by the committee, which, as controversial as it may be, better playoff matchup, not necessarily the right thing to do, or at least based on what like the precedent was of letting teams into the college football playoff. We'll get to that. NFL Week 13, like I said, and the Yankees will catch up on those Juan Soto sweepstakes and the Yamamoto sweepstakes. It's been pretty hectic and pretty frustrating to see some of the reports that are coming out and like how the Yankees just are not getting it done right now. So we'll start with that, then college football, then NFL Week 13. So let's start with the Yankees, because the Yankees have been in this like weird back and forth. They're in the running for Soto. Reportedly, they're in the running for Yamamoto. But a couple days ago, it was reported that momentum has stalled between the Padres and the Yankees. Now, here's what it is reported. This is from, I guess this would be from Andy Martino, but he... I actually don't know if this is from him, but I'm looking at it from Eric from Hubs from Barstool. His Twitter account, he tweeted out this little nugget from where this report is from. But reportedly, the Padres were asking for Michael King, Drew Thorpe, who's a prospect in the minors, and as many as 4 to 5 other prospects, including Randy Vasquez, Johnny Brito. And they're also looking for salary cap relief. Well, not there's no salary cap relief, but they're looking for salary relief for Trent Grisham. They don't want to have Trent Grisham on their books anymore. What are we waiting for? Like, what is Cashman plays hardball notoriously. As recently as last year, he was playing hardball with Aaron Judge, the now captain of the New York Yankees. He was playing hardball with. And it was about nonsense and how Steinbrenner had to step in and just say, hey, Aaron, what do you want? And he was like, we're looking for this. And Steinbrenner said, okay, that's it. And we're going to make you the captain. And Judge signed the deal like almost immediately. So Cashman has, and if you watch the Jeter documentary, the captain of the Jeter documentary during arbitration, like Jeter talks about arbitration with Cashman and how much that like kind of messed him up, and it really allows any other player that's been through arbitration really allows you to see like what these people think of you, you know, regardless of what you've done for them or for the franchise. So it's pretty messed up. And I would not be surprised if Cashman just completely fumbled this. But I mean, from the names I listed off, give them all for Juan Soto. It is legitimately not even a question in my mind to give up Drew Thorpe, Johnny Brito, Michael King, and whoever else. This is the thing too. The people that have been that Cashman has been trying to protect, the Padres aren't even asking for Volpe, Peraza, Dominguez, Wells. Like none of these players are the Padres are even interested in. They want pitching prospects because they're going to lose Blake Snell because Blake Snell is also a free agent. So they're probably going to lose Blake Snell. They want pitching prospects. They're getting rid of Juan Soto. Like they are trying to reset in a way here after a very disappointing year. And they're not even asking for the guys that you really, really covet. So like get rid of them. I don't understand what the holdup is. And then there was a report that came out yesterday or 2 days ago as well that like the Blue Jays were hot in pursuit of Soto and they were making some headway in negotiations. If you lose Juan Soto to a division rival like the Toronto Blue Jays, you are a moron. Like there is no reason why Juan Soto should not be in pinstripes. And I don't usually talk this way, you know, about, oh, the Yankees should just go get so-and-so or go get this person, whatever. But like the Yankees had an opportunity to sign Bryce Harper when he was a free agent and they didn't pursue him. period. It's not like they really pushed hard, but in the end, Philly just, you know, ended up offering more and Bryce wanted to be there and that was it. The Yankees didn't even pursue Bryce Harper. They didn't pursue trading for Matt Olson at the trade deadline when they could have, when there was interest in him playing for the Yankees. They didn't pursue him. And look at how they are now, right? This is going, you're going on your third opportunity to sign a big time player that could change your team, legitimately change your team in a way that no player has done. You try to have that player with Giancarlo Stanton. You traded for Giancarlo Stanton and you tried to get that to work. You tried to make that the big play that put you over the top and it didn't. But here's the thing. And I understand that's probably why maybe you're a little scared. Like, hey, we traded for a big time player before, whatever. It's nonsense to be scared. Juan Soto is bulletproof right now. He is bulletproof. Outside of, I'm knocking on wood here, so you can hear that. Outside of any injury happening, Juan Soto's game ages like fine wine. He's not reliant on power, although he does have it. He's an excellent hitter. And probably the most important part of his game that the Yankees so desperately need is that he gets on base. He gets on base a lot. And that changes your lineup and that changes your team and how you play baseball. And if the Yankees are really hell-bent on being like, okay, we're going to kind of reset our ways, and it's not going to be about home runs and exit velo, but it's going to be about getting on base and maybe making contact more and more and more rather than prioritizing the big bombs, right? Juan Soto gives you everything you want. He puts the ball in play. He gets on base. He hits home runs. Like, he hits, his slugging percentage is great. Like, he is an unbelievable, like a generational baseball player. And he is 24 years old. You can sign him to a 10-year contract. And when he's done, he'll still probably be playing high-level baseball. Like, that is the kind of baseball player you're looking at here. So if it takes 4, 5, 6 prospects that aren't even the guys that you think are ready to contribute, it's a no-brainer in my mind that you have to go and get this guy. No-brainer. Judge, Soto, Dominguez should be the starting outfield for the Yankees for the foreseeable future. There's no doubt in my mind. And then it came out that like Yamamoto is their number one priority because at the end of the day, he is a free agent. He is going to the highest bidder, most likely. There's a lot of speculation that, you know, the Dodgers are heavy in pursuit. The Mets and Giants should not be counted out, but it feels like it's really boiling down to the Yankees or the Dodgers for Yamamoto, which doesn't really surprise me. They are probably willing to spend the most. I don't think that Cashman or Hal Steinbrenner are going to be like, well, we don't want to pay Juan Soto. I think it really is them, about them giving up, like, which to me, no disrespect to these guys, just meaningless prospects. The best case scenario is that one of these pitchers ends up being half the player that, you know, Gerrit Cole is. That's the best case scenario. Like, these guys that you have right now are not generational prospects. So trade them for Juan Soto. And even if they are good, Juan Soto is better. That I cannot be more clear about how much I want this guy in pinstripes. He is generational. Like, Yamamoto, all things considered, like, I don't know much about him. I know he's a sensational Japanese player. And I know I would love to add him to the rotation. Like, having another ace is, there's no one in baseball that wouldn't want that. Like, but I'm looking at a guy that I've seen play a lot of baseball. So that's why I'm a little bit more passionate in how I'm talking about Soto rather than Yamamoto, which is like, no disrespect to him. I know he's great, but, and to be fair, the Yankees and the Dodgers, it makes sense why they have those two teams at the top in the reports because they have history with great Japanese players, right? So I get that, and you want to be in heavy pursuit, and it's probably pretty difficult to try and get both, but like it shouldn't be difficult. I think Cashman makes it difficult, but it should not be difficult. Yamamoto, at the end of the day, it's his decision. You know, the Yankees can offer whatever they want, but if he wants to play in LA, then so be it. It is what it is. Also, the Yankees, we're not going to hear anything about the Shohei Ohtani negotiations because he said he'd hold it against teams, and no team's going to be leaking any info about that because they don't want him to hold it against them. They want the best shot. So, but with Ohtani, like, are the Yankees going to be in on him? How many guys are they in on? Like, Bellinger's a free agent. He was connected to the Yankees loosely during the trade deadline. That maybe that was someone that they can go get. I personally don't, if we're spending money, the Yankees are in the spending business this offseason, which they should be. It's most likely Soto, Yamamoto, and then everyone else. I love Shohei Ohtani. I think he's an incredible talent. The arm is a red flag, and he had a couple of healthy seasons, and those two fully healthy seasons, he had three fully healthy seasons, and two of them, he won the MVP. He's sensational. He is generational. He is. But you're not signing, like, you're signing two. I think that is what the Yankees need, is like they're signing two of any of these guys. That's the dream. I would rather it be Yamamoto and Soto. Like, those are two guys that absolutely would be critical to the Yankees in righting the ship, because it's a mess right now. And to add a good pitcher with the skill set that Juan Soto provides on offense completely changes the dynamic of your team. So every time I see a report about, like, the Yankees and Cashman are in deep negotiations for Soto, but the Padres are asking for, like, so-and-so and this and this and this, who cares? Like, it honestly pisses me off. I would have been so quick to snap on the Padres' demands, it would have made their head spin. It literally would have made them question whether they should trade Juan Soto at all. Like, I don't know if that's Cashman's game plan. Is like, if we say yes too quickly, they actually might get scared and run off to someone else. But my God, it is so black and white to me about what we could give up for Juan Soto. Literally anyone under the sun that's not like Jason Dominguez, Volpe, and that's probably it. Like, I'd even be willing to send off Austin Wells. They won't, but, and even getting Trent Grisham as a backup, yeah, sure, maybe you're taking on some money there that you might not want to take on, but like, if it means getting Juan Soto, again, who cares? But the reports coming out that Yamamoto is kind of the number one priority. Number one free agent priority, ideally, but I would very much like Juan Soto to be the guy that, like, if all else fails, if everything else falls through, but we still come out with Juan Soto and only Juan Soto, I can put my head on my pillow at night and sleep peacefully, because that's just what this guy brings. Like, he's awesome, man. Like, he's talked about playing in New York. He likes being in New York. He likes playing in New York. Like, there's just absolutely no reason why he shouldn't be in pinstripes. He's the guy. He is the guy. So that's the quick baseball update. You know, there are the reports left and right we're getting sporadically. It's just, that's the way baseball is. Like, the NBA is a frenzy of free agency, like, basically all at once, rapid fire, player signs here, player signs here, there's a trade, whatever. NFL, same thing. Trade deadlines aren't as crazy in the NFL, but like, the offseason, basically a shorter period of time where it's like big money, big money, big money, big money. The MLB is just a long, long, it's a long season, and it's a long offseason with a ton of, like, nitpicking, meticulous negotiations that go on, a lot of silence just in general. You know, again, the NBA, there's always like rumblings and like, you know, so-and-so might sign here, or but now, you know, this team's interested, whatever. Baseball, literally, there's reports that come out where it's like negotiations are heating up, negotiations have stalled, X team is in hot pursuit of Y player. And that's basically all you get for like weeks and weeks and weeks on end until it is then finally done. Basically, probably in December, January, February, like this happens. And then February is the start of spring training. So it's like December is really your month, maybe January. But after that, it's like you're not getting much. There's no like rapid fire, bang, 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 these people are signing. It's a very long and drawn out process, for better or for worse. But that is what has been reported over the past week, over the weekend, with Soto and Yamamoto and the Yankees and their hot pursuit of both of these guys. Stalled being in the negotiate being used to describe the Padres and Yankees negotiations is not what I want to hear. So I hope those kind of pick up. If Juan Soto goes anywhere in the AL East that isn't the New York Yankees, like it's reported that the Blue Jays are really interested in Soto as well, and also have negotiations heating up, that will make my head spin. That will be an inexcusable loss. Because if you miss out on Soto and you end up signing Yamamoto and Bellinger, I guess you can look at that as a win. But like Soto is so much more of a sure thing than Cody Bellinger. And I love Cody Bellinger. I am a Cody Bellinger supporter. I want him to, when he was going downhill with the Dodgers, it broke my heart. I was like, how is this happening? I know this guy's a good baseball player. I don't understand what is happening. And for him to have the year he had in Chicago, it made me so happy for him. And to be able to see like this is Cody Bellinger. This is last few years in LA they're not the norm. Something got messed up. His approach, his psyche, maybe like the long draw that he, like I don't know, the pressure. I have no idea. I hope it's not the pressure, but because being in New York's not going to help you. If expectations is the reason why you weren't a good baseball player in LA at the end, then we're going to have a huge problem in New York. But, you know, I don't know what it was. Someone tweaked something in his swing. Maybe it was a mental like approach thing. I don't know. There's really no, because his swing looks almost the same. It's just that now he's hitting the ball. He's just making a lot more contact. So I don't know. Like his stance didn't really drastically change. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what's different with Cody Bellinger, but he is different now. He's back to his old ways. So maybe he reverted back to something. I don't know, but he's a beast and I love him. I just, if we lose out on Soto and settle for Bellinger, it's going to irk me, because especially if Soto ends up with like the Blue Jays, like that's reported. Now you're looking at like a direct one-to-one comparison. Like, okay, the Blue Jays got Soto, we got Bellinger. And then the next couple of years is just going to be an all-out look at these stats compared to these stats. And that's not good for anybody. So I don't know, man. It's scary. Scary hours, dude. Hopefully. So it'll be a reminder again in a couple weeks. We're going to go on break for Christmas through the new year. So the 18th is going to be, so it's the fourth episode next week. And then another episode after that. So including this one, three more episodes before the holiday break. Ideally something happens before then, before Christmas, where we have a stronger sense of where these guys are going to land. Or maybe even have something that's totally done. Yamamoto is he's like a posted international player. So they only they have a set deadline. And I believe it's like the first week of January. So maybe our first episode back, if it goes down to the wire, like the deadline, our first episode back I should be able to have an answer for at least Yamamoto. And I would imagine by January, considering you're only about like a month or a little bit more than a month out from spring training, pitchers and catchers, and then after that, players. January is generally like those teams, those guys are going to be on their new teams. So I like it to happen before Christmas, but if I have to wait till after Christmas to talk about it, I still will talk about it, even if it's like weeks after, you know, I have to talk about it, of course. But that's the update for the MLB offseason. And we'll move to college football, which has everyone in a tizzy this past weekend, this past Sunday, the college football playoff selection show. They announced the top four teams that were participating in the college football playoff this year. And it is number one, Michigan, the Big Ten winners undefeated. Number two, Washington, the Pac-12, final year of the Pac-12, RIP. The Pac-12 winners undefeated. Number three, the Big 12 champs, Texas, one loss, 12-1. And the final slot, the SEC champions, Alabama, 12-1. No Florida State, no Georgia. This is controversial, to say the least, what has happened here. So to go through the top ones, obviously, Michigan, no-brainer, number one. They got it locked up. Washington, same thing, no-brainer. Pac-12, number one. They're good, too. Number three is Texas. So this involves the last two spots, four teams. Texas, Alabama, FSU, Florida State, and Georgia. Georgia was number one. They lost to Alabama in the SEC. That basically kills them. Regardless of how they played all year, regardless of how long they were at number one, it means nothing. You didn't win the SEC. You now have the same record as Alabama. If Alabama has two losses and they beat Georgia, Alabama's not in. Georgia still stays alive, and they're probably in there instead. Alabama lost in week two to Texas, won 11 straight games. They were 1-1 after that. They won 11 straight games to end 12-1. They won the SEC. They're in. Big bad Nick Saban. Georgia is out. They're dead. That's over. Texas wins the Big 12. They beat Alabama. They also have to be in. So the team that gets screwed out of this is Florida State. Undefeated Florida State, Power 5, ACC champion, left out of the college football playoff. Jordan Travis, their starting quarterback, injured. They're playing with like a third stringer or a second stringer. Backup, their offense looks pretty dreadful. But they win out the last two or three games of the season it was. They win the ACC, still left out of the playoff. Why does this happen? There's no precedent for this ever happening. It has always been, if you are a Power 5 school, aka the ACC, the SEC, the Big 10, the Big 12, and the Pac-12, if you're in one of those five conferences and you go undefeated and you win your conference, you are an automatic lock for the college football playoff. And there's three teams that did that this year: Michigan, Washington, and Florida State. And Florida State was left out in favor of Alabama, the SEC champion, getting in, because Georgia was not going to get in. And the committee was not going to let the SEC not be represented in the college football playoff, because that is their biggest and their best conference. And to not have anyone from that conference in the college football playoff was basically unthinkable. Texas, one loss. They beat Alabama, the now SEC champs, which means a ton. You need to put them in. So now Florida, even though they should be a lock over, what it should have been, if we're going on like the past and what had it's always been shown about, is that Georgia loses to Alabama. Texas beat Alabama. Texas is in. Florida State is undefeated Power 5 conference champion. They're in. Michigan, Washington, Florida State, undefeated Power 5 champions. They're all in. Georgia and Alabama have the same record. Alabama's the SEC champ. Texas is the Big 12 champ. Texas beat Alabama. Texas is in. That is, if you look at the history of the college football playoff, that is really kind of how it probably should have gone. And if Jordan Travis was healthy, I think that is probably how it shakes up. That or Texas is the one that gets snubbed and Alabama sneaks in as the SEC champs at 12-1, even though they lost to Texas. The committee loves Alabama. So if anything, maybe that is how it's, if anything, Texas is the one being snubbed, not Florida State. But because they don't have their starting quarterback, Florida State, it's easy to kind of dismiss them and be like, well, do we want a repeat of TCU last year? Because remember, TCU got in over Alabama last year. They ended up beating Michigan in the college football playoff and then got absolutely ragdolled by Georgia in the national championship game. So the committee doesn't want that. They don't want that anymore. And if you look at the circumstances as well, this is the last year that we have only four teams. Next year, it moves to 12. So are we going to have like controversies around like the 10, 11, 12 spots and the 13, 14 spots, 15 spots, whatever? Yeah. But at the end of the day, like those teams, like Michigan, Ohio State, Alabama, Georgia, like none of these teams are ever going to miss a college football playoff basically ever again, unless they have like 2, 3, 4 losses, which, you know, whatever, that's probably never going to happen. But those are like, they'll never miss a playoff again. That's just the way it is. So like, did the committee look at it and say, hey, Florida State, yeah, you're going to get hosed this year, but next year, like you're probably okay. You know, you have nothing to worry about next year. Or maybe even the year after that. But that doesn't make it fair. But the reasoning is like, we had TCU last year. It blew up in our faces because the game was so uncompetitive. What do we want? Do we want Florida State in undefeated ACC champ with a really kind of tough to watch offense now? Or do we want Alabama, Nick Saban, the most recognizable brand in college football, in the college football playoff at number 4, playing number 1 seeded Michigan? Which, go look up that video of the room of like Michigan coaches and staffers and players seeing that Alabama got the number 4 seed. It was like an audible gasp in the room. I would be shocked. Any Michigan fan, player, et cetera, saying like, I'm glad we got Alabama. We have to beat everyone else. We'll do it. You're a fool. It's never fun to go up against Alabama and Nick Saban in big time games. It's not, because more times than not, you're going to lose. So Michigan, that's a tough first game. But if Michigan beats Alabama, they're winning the national championship, because Washington and Texas, I think Texas is going to steamroll Washington. Alabama, Michigan, whoever comes out of that side of the bracket, the 1 or 4 seed, they're winning it. I don't think Texas has beaten Alabama and they could beat Alabama. So if you have Bama, Texas as a national championship game, there's a real chance that Texas can win. But I mean, it's tough. I mean, I still say Michigan or Alabama, whoever wins that game probably wins the national championship. I will say that. I'm kind of rooting for Texas, though. I am kind of rooting for Texas. And low-key, after everything that's happened with Michigan and that program, it would be a giant middle finger to the Big Ten and basically all of college football that wanted them to be like burned at the stake. For them to win a national championship would be like the truest sense of poetic justice. It would be so funny and just a giant middle finger to all of those people. And I kind of want that. I kind of want that. That would be sick. But at the end of the day, you look at Florida State. Is it fair what happened to them? Objectively, no. It's not fair, because there's no precedent for that ever happening. They're a Power 5 champion, undefeated. They've won every game on their schedule like they have been asked to do to get in, and they still didn't get in. But is the college football playoff matchups better now that Florida State is not in it? Yes. Michigan, Alabama is a far more intriguing matchup than Michigan, Florida State. in all likelihood, the Michigan-Florida State game, kind of, it looks like the Big Ten championship game between Michigan and Iowa. There's not many points scored. Michigan runs away with it. The game's over. Michigan-Alabama holds a lot more weight to it in terms of programs, in terms of players, in terms of coaches, in terms of like just weight of the game. Michigan-Florida State does not. So the committee, even though it wasn't probably the right thing to do, said, we're going to let the team in. We're not going to exclude the SEC entirely. That would be an absolute self-inflicted wound to college football to not let anyone in the SEC in. So we're going to snub Florida State. And that's just the way it broke down. Like, they absolutely got the short end of the stick. College football and the playoff will probably be better off for it in terms of like ratings and viewership and competitiveness. They'll be better off, but that doesn't mean it was objectively the right thing to do. Like, Florida State absolutely 100% earned a spot in that playoff. They earned a chance to try and play the game. And that's what like football is about. The NBA, the MLB, hockey, right? Like, they're all best of series. Football is you got to go one day, one night, and win a football game. And how many times in the pros, in college it's less so because sometimes there's just such wide gaps in talent that it's hard to overcome that. But in professional football, at least in that sense, like, how many times have we seen upsets? Even though there's clearly a better team, sometimes the other team wins. And in college football, with Florida State being in a Power Five like the ACC, even though the ACC's, you know, they're not really good this year, but to have them there and to not even get a chance to win every game on your schedule, to win your conference like you are asked to do, and to not even get a chance feels wrong. And I get, I'm like not saying anything that's revolutionary here. There's a ton of people who agree with me in every aspect. Like, yeah, it's better for college football. Yes, they're better. They're lined up to be more competitive games. But Florida State not even getting a chance is wild. It's wild. It is literally an unprecedented decision that the committee made this year to keep someone with Florida State's resume out of the college football playoff in favor of a team that, like Alabama, yes, they're the SEC champs. Yes, they beat Georgia. But the week before, they needed a Hail Mary miracle on a fourth and goal from the 30 to beat Auburn, who's not Auburn stinks. And they just barely beat Auburn. So when you look at that and then you see they beat Georgia by 3, and I know a win is a win is a win. So on the final stat sheet, Auburn's a W and Georgia's a W. But like, you beat Georgia by 3, a very good team, and you almost lost to Auburn, who's horrible. So it's like, what Alabama are you? You're obviously betting on the SEC champion beating Georgia, Alabama team to show up and play Michigan. But like, there's a real chance that the Alabama team that played Auburn shows up and Michigan beats the shit out of them. It is. A crazy leap to just not even give Florida State a shot. I totally understand the decision. Again, from like a logistics standpoint, I get the decision. And honestly, I think the biggest factor is that Jordan Travis isn't there, but also a huge factor in my opinion is that this is the last year of the 4-team college football playoff format. And then it moves to 12 teams. So the playoff committee might've just said, screw it. We're going to bear this storm of people, you know, bitching and moaning and whining about how we left Florida State out because it's never been done before. And it was a total misrepresentation of the SEC, of the college football playoff and like how they operate and all that. We're just going to weather the storm and we'll come out on the other end, and the championship game and the college football playoff game, those games that happen New Year's Day and the championship, hopefully everything is competitive and it's fun and people have fun and everyone recognizes like, hey, I'm really glad we had these matchups instead of having to deal with potentially a really bad Florida State game. And then the only ones who will remember are the people from who were on the Florida State team, the coaches on that team, the people at the school, the boosters, all that. They'll be the only ones who remember or he even care. And then everyone else will just kind of be like, yeah, this was the right decision. And then next year, the college football playoff will be 12 games. And, you know, we won't have to worry about who gets in the top 4, 5, 6, 7 seeds because it'll just be there, you know? Pretty crazy. I couldn't believe, everyone kept talking about it. And I was like, there's just no way. There's no way they leave Florida State out. And they did. And they did. It's pretty insane. But something that I was thinking about is the Orange Bowl now is Florida State, Georgia. Georgia, I think, is like they're double digit favorites, like 2 touchdowns. What would happen in a world where Florida State just says, we don't want to play this game? I mean, what happens? Sure. All right. Whatever. You forfeit the law, you forfeit the game and you lose. That's fine. But like, what does that look like? You know, is it possible? Is it possible to stand up to a committee and a system that is college football to be able to do that? And, you know, these, a lot of people for these schools in the South too, are just like these crazy, crazy, crazy college football fans. So like, what does a boycott of that look like? What does it look like if Florida State just says, hey, like, you screwed us, we're going to screw you. Can they reasonably boycott that game? Is it fair to any of the players on that team? No, probably not. Is it fair to the coaches? No, probably not. Is it fair to the fans? No, probably not. But at the same time, the unity in that message you would send would be like astronomical. Now, of course, this is never going to happen. Florida State's going to be angry and pissed off, and they're just going to go and play this game against Georgia. And quite honestly, they're probably not going to care about the outcome. If they win, maybe they do the whole like, we're actually the real champions in college football, barring like Washington or Michigan winning and being undefeated. You can go that route. It's a bit pathetic to go that route. But at the end of the day, if you somehow upset Georgia and you walk out of there undefeated with the Orange Bowl victory, you can hold up with your head up high and said, see, and could say, see, we would have been a threat in the college football playoff. That's a stance you can take. If you lose to Georgia, people will point at you and be like, hey, look, this would have been the same outcome if you played Michigan. Would have been the same outcome. So is that really, is there any like winning scenario there? I personally would love to see history. Boycott the game. We're not playing Georgia. This is bullshit. We don't want to play for the Orange Bowl. We deserve a shot to play for the championship. This is nonsense. I would love to see that. It's not going to happen, but I would love to see it. So we'll move on from college and we'll tackle the NFL. Week 13, quite the week. A lot of good games in the 1 o'clock slot and then only 3 games in the 4 o'clock slot. 2 of them were like borderline unwatchable. So everyone was tuned in to the Niners and Philly game, which was supposed to be electric, but the Niners ended up just beating the brakes off of Philly, which I love it. I love it. I think the Niners are probably the best team in football. Not probably. They are the best team in football. And we'll get to that, obviously, when we get to the game. But like, oh my goodness, what a ass beating that was. To start, the Thursday night game, real quick, Cowboys win 41-35. Highlights from this. I bet on Geno Smith to throw an interception when he threw an interception and won, which was a great bet. I threw like $4. I threw like $4 on it and I won $52. It was sick. So that was awesome. But for the Seahawks, I mean, now you're staring death in the face because this was like your one real opportunity to come out with a W during this gruesome stretch of games, because you played the Niners, now you, then you played the Cowboys, both losses. Now you play the Niners again and then the Eagles, which, I mean, you're probably looking at four losses in a row. Real bad skid. It's tough. It's a tough schedule. Probably the most difficult four-week stretch that any team has had to face this year. It's terrible, but the Cowboys come out on top, 41-35, a shootout. Al Michaels on Thursday Night Football finally gets a really good game to call. DK Metcalf balled out. It was a great game to watch. Sunday's games. Quietly, the Chargers beat the Patriots 6-0. It was pouring in the entire Northeast this week, or on Sunday. The entire Northeast. New York, it was pouring in. This game in Massachusetts, New England, it was pouring. Pittsburgh, Arizona, Pittsburgh got suspended multiple times because the rain was so bad. The rain and the wind was so bad, and they had that lake effect there because, you know, the former Heinz Field is right there. So Pittsburgh and the Cardinals got suspended. It was raining in Florida. It was just an absolute mess, basically, in the entire East Coast. So the Chargers win this game 6-0. I don't have words for this game. So I think we're just going to call it what it is. The Chargers won. They're 5-7. The Patriots lost. They're 2-10. They have the second overall pick still. And that's it. That's the game. I'm not even going to spend a moment of this podcast bashing on the Chargers more than I already do. If you saw anything of this game, you know that I'm right about most of my Chargers takes, to be honest. So this just is what it is. The Chargers win 6-0. I did bet on them to cover 4.5, though, and they did it without scoring a touchdown. Pretty cool. So shout out to them. I think that was the first time I bet on the Chargers all year. Cardinals Steelers, as mentioned, this game was suspended multiple times and ended super late, even though it was a 1 o'clock game. The Cardinals beat up on the Steelers 24-10. Marquise Brown left this game. Hollywood Brown, he left the game. Didn't matter for the Cardinals. Kenny Pickett, though, left this game for the Steelers. And I feel like Kenny Pickett he gets banged up a lot. This time it was his ankle. So he leaves the game. Trubisky's in. You're basically shot. Tough loss for the Steelers here. They were sitting at 7-4, looking to get to 8-4, continue the winning games maybe that they shouldn't have won. But the Cardinals, not nearly as bad of a team, not even close with Kyler Murray back. They're now 3-10. I think they had like the third pick in the draft now. Colts, Titans, this game came down to the wire as well. Overtime win for the Colts. They get to 7-5, 31-28, a game-winning overtime touchdown pass to Gardner Minshew. From Gardner Minshew to Michael Pittman. The Colts, man, Shane Steichen and D'Amico Ryans are easily the top two front runners for coach of the year. I think whichever one of them ends up making the playoffs is the one that's going to get it. You look at Shane Steichen here and losing his rookie quarterback, getting Gardner Minshew, which no disrespect to Gardner Minshew, but also respect to Gardner Minshew because he's been balling out, but you're playing with your backup guy now. You have to completely change your game plan and really work the offense and get the ball to your best guys. And Gardner Minshew's doing it really well. Michael Pittman is having a sensational year. Jonathan Taylor, you're dealing with that now. He gets surgery on his thumb. He's out for the next few weeks. Probably be back for the playoffs if the Colts are in contention, playoff contention. He'll be back for, I think, like the last week or so, week of the season. I think that it was like 3 to 4 weeks or 3 to 5 weeks for his surgery. But you're dealing with that now, too, on top of losing your quarterback. And then just you're finding ways to win, man. Like the Colts are just finding ways to win. They're 7-5. They are firmly in the playoff hunt. And what's crazy is, like, low key, they're still hunting the division. The Jags and they're up there, but I mean, it's not like, I don't think the Jags are gonna really choke it away, but like they're hot. they are hot, the Colts, man. It's actually kind of fun to watch them play football. As for the Titans, this is a tough loss. Derrick Henry leaves this game with an injury. And he was cooking up. I mean, I had him in a parlay that hit. I took his over rushing yards. It was like 70 and a half. And I took him to score a touchdown. He ran for on 21 carries, 102 yards and two touchdowns. But he wasn't available, I don't think, during overtime. I'm not sure when he left. You know, this game I'm watching on Sunday Ticket and that Red Zone. This game's on and off. I'm not sure exactly when Derrick Henry got hurt, although it was reported he was in concussion protocol. I did get a report while I was recording this that he is actually not in concussion protocol. So he did leave the game, didn't finish, but he looks like he should be on track to play again next week. But yeah, I mean, it's just a tough situation over there in Tennessee right now. Texans, Broncos, what a game this was. Down to the wire, Mr. Unlimited, Russell Wilson with a chance to win the game. You're at like the 10, I think it is. Clock ticking down, final seconds. He escapes a sack, throws it into the back of the end zone. The ball is too low. It is picked off, and the Texans hang on to win 22-17. Derek Stingley had a couple picks this game. One was just absolutely sensational because Cortland Sutton was open. Russ threw it well, but Stingley, coming from the outside numbers in, jumped the route just slightly and dove and ended up catching the football like a wide receiver as he jumped the route. He risked it all, because if he missed that or he came up short or he was a little too early, he was a little too late in jumping that route and the ball got by him, Cortland Sutton's catching the ball and he's running in for a touchdown untouched. But Derek Stingley just made an unbelievable play on the ball. So he had two picks, which were pretty great. He had a great game. Will Anderson tipped a ball that got picked off. So the Broncos, they are a team that is not built to play from behind. And despite the turnovers, the defense kept them in it long enough to give them a shot at the end of the game to put the ball in the end zone. Texans defense held strong. And they were able to secure the victory with another interception. But three interceptions for Russell Wilson. Tough loss. That snaps their winning streak. I think the analytics, like the percentages for making the playoffs for this game were like night and day for whoever won. Because both teams were 6-5. And it was like whoever wins has like a high 70s, low 80s% chance or something like that of making the playoffs. And whoever loses plummets down to like 20% to make the playoffs. So the Broncos now are sitting at 6-6. Houston is 7-5. I'm really rooting for Russell Wilson. I was really rooting for him. I hope they still somehow sneak into the playoffs. But it seems pretty unsure, maybe even unlikely now that they do. CJ Stroud and the Texans, again, I mean, I mentioned Shane Steichen and D'Amico Ryans. D'Amico Ryans is just doing a sensational job with this team. All their draft picks have hit. Like, Stingley's good. He struggled his rookie year, and then he was injured a little bit, but he's good. Will Anderson's good. CJ Stroud is phenomenal. I maintain my take. I'm going to say this again. I think CJ Stroud is probably the best quarterback in the AFC South right now. He really is. I mean, he airs it out, and he airs it out well. Trevor Lawrence doesn't air it out. Very conservative, sticks to the game plan. Like, CJ Stroud makes shit happen. Trevor Lawrence, I feel like, doesn't to that capacity. And that is an X factor for me. Like, I think, like, if you give your ball to the quarterback and say, go win us a football game, I'm more confident in CJ Stroud than doing it than Trevor Lawrence. I fully believe that. And that might age like milk, but who knows? If it doesn't, oh man, I'm looking good. But I'll stand by that. I think CJ Stroud is phenomenal, dude. So the Texans are 7-5. They have a good team built around them. The one devastating thing that came from this game was Tank Dell, fractured fibula. He's done for the year. He was emerging with Stroud as like, that was his number one guy. He was a deep threat. He was his go-to receiver. And now he is, he's out for the year. So that is a huge blow for the Texans. But Nico Collins, who was, it was like Nico Collins was on fire, and then Tank Dell emerged as this like star that was going to be paired with CJ Stroud, and then he got injured, and what happens this game? The game Tank Dell gets injured. Nico Collins steps back up to the plate and hits a goddamn home run. 9 catches, 191 yards, and a touchdown for Nico Collins against a Denver team that has been playing really well, and a Denver team that has been turning the ball over at like an astronomical rate. No turnovers for the Texans. Again, for Denver, Denver being a totally different team, like they have been playing good, clean football. They muck it out. They run the ball. They make, like, Russ makes passes when he needs to. And their defense has been taking the ball away and been playing strong and just in general playing tough defense. They still put them in a position, like the team still was in a position to win at the end of the game, which is something that if you went into this in like week two and were like, yeah, this Broncos team, they lost a turnover battle like 3-0. How do you think the game went? You'd probably think that team got blown out of the water. But the fact that it was only a one possession game with a chance to win at the end there speaks a lot to how they have grown and developed and changed as a team. But I still don't, like, they're not obviously built to play from behind, yet here they were at the end with a chance to win it. So unfortunate that they lost, because I'm pulling for them, but I do love me some Houston Texans wins right now, man. It's hard to hate on the Texans right now. Lions, Saints, this game got really out of control really quickly, and then the Saints kind of woke up. They still lost, but they woke up. It was 21-0. In the first quarter. And then the Saints defense woke up and the Lions defense kind of started sputtering again. Final score is 33-28. Lions win. They're 9-3. Saints are 5-7. I hate watching the Saints play football. Like every week, I watch the Saints just play a disgusting brand of football that makes me want to tear my hair out. I cannot imagine how real Saints fans feel about this team. It's probably mind-numbing, frustration, exhausting. Like, Dennis Allen coaching is horrible. And they did put points on the board, but who knows? If Derek Carr stays in this game, maybe they do rally. But again, he got injured. He is banged up. I mean, Derek Carr is busted into like a billion pieces right now. He's really in a tough spot. Basically a lose-lose situation in my eyes. Like, I don't think he's particularly good when he does play. But like, I do respect him for playing when he's injured. But now he's just like super banged up. So I would just let him rest. Like, you're not in contention. You're not going to win this division. You're not a very good football team. I think really it comes down to coaching and execution and game planning on that end. I think you have a ton of talent. I mean, Kamara, you have a solid O-line. Olave is a beast. Rashid Shaheed is injured, but like, he's pretty good. The defense has been good for a while. You know, they've had some off games this year, but for the most part, it's a solid unit. They just have absolutely no idea. Like, they are, once Taysom Hill leaves football forever, it'll be the Saints will be better off. This Taysom Hill should have, the Saints should have gotten rid of Taysom Hill when Sean Payton left. The Saints should have gotten rid of Taysom Hill when Sean Payton left. He should have been off the roster. Whatever it takes, whatever dead cap, get him off the roster. Don't talk to me about weapons. Don't talk to me about, like, well, he scores touchdowns and now all these different packages you can use him in. I'm good on it, dude. I'm good on it. As far as I know, whenever he's in the game, he's taking touches away from better players. That's just how I see Taysom Hill. I don't want him anywhere near that offense. He takes touches away from Kamara. He takes under center snaps away from Derek Carr. Like, your starting quarterback is getting taken out of the game for Taysom Hill. And again, with Sean Payton and at the end of Drew Brees' career, to throw in that wrinkle that is Taysom Hill, it was innovative. It was kind of fun. Like, that's Sean Payton. That's what he does. He's a smart offensive mind. You know, you're trying to compensate a little bit for your aging quarterback. I understand that 100%, but that is not the case anymore. So whenever I see Taysom Hill in the game, it makes me angry because he's not going to do anything other than run the football. Just like as soon as he's in the game, man coverage, blitz, send six guys. Like you need to stop that at all costs because he's not going to do anything other than run with the read. It's a read option every time, and he runs every time. It's not even an option. It's stupid. It's frustrating to watch. And like I said, whenever he's in the game, he is actively taking away touches from guys who are better than him. And it was fun with Sean Payton and an old Drew Brees, but it's not fun anymore because you're not winning. Falcons, Jets. I had this game in my parlay. Falcons minus -2. It was gross, but they won. The Falcons, they're 6-6. They win 13-8. There was one touchdown in this game and a few field goals and a safety. It was horrible to watch. Tim Boyle was in. He's horrible. I actually think he's worse and a worse option than Zach Wilson. Trevor Siemian also just as bad. Like they're both worse than Zach Wilson. I think it's kind of crazy how no one has called like any type of veteran up to try and like right the ship of this team because Tim Boyle and Trevor Siemian are horrible. You're not going to go back to Zach Wilson now. It's that ship has sailed. So it's pretty embarrassing what's happening here in New York. Another game where the Jets defense dominated, like they tackled Bijan in the end zone for a safety. The defense held up and the offense just could not even like put 4 or 5 field goals on the board. Like they couldn't even get in field goal range. It's pretty despicable and it's unwatchable. I don't know how anyone would ever, I don't know how or why anyone, Jets fan or not, would subject themselves to watching this team play football. It's despicable. And of course, in very Aaron Rodgers like fashion, at 12:30, like half an hour before tip off or kickoff, it's announced that Aaron Rodgers will not return for the rest of the year. So this whole like, I'm coming back. This is my window. I'm coming back. Blah, 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 blah. And to then just be like, yeah, no, he's not coming back. Anyone who thought Aaron Rodgers was coming back from an Achilles tear in like 4 months is a nut job. Okay. You are an absolute head case. There's in no scenario in the entire history of the world can a human body overcome an injury like that and go out and play professional football. You are a nut job if you actually thought that was ever going to happen. Crazy person. And Aaron Rodgers was just blowing smoke up everyone's ass because he was like, oh, I'm going to come back. We're trying some real new techniques, some real revolutionary stuff. No, you're not. You might be healthy. You might have rehabbed quicker than any average person tearing their Achilles would have because you were able to spend the time and the resources to rehab your Achilles. And for a normal person, you could probably walk around without a boot, without crutches right now and be fine for a normal person. But to play professional football, there is no way in hell you can ever do that. It was a fake pipe dream that the Jets and Aaron Rodgers cooked up to try and like keep some faith for the team, but they finally sold it off at the end here now before this week. And we're like, yeah, no, we were kidding. It's he's not coming back this year. See you next year. The 6-6 Falcons are going to win the NFC South. That division's trash. Dolphins, Commanders, another huge day for the Dolphins offense. Tyreek Hill, 2 touchdowns, over 100 yards. I think he has 1,400 yards, a little over 1,400 yards now. And he's looking to break 2,000. So we're on watch. He's trending in that direction. But it was very funny how this game ended. I mean, Devon Achane ended up like scoring a touchdown with 2 minutes left to make it 45-15. And then the Commanders just like ran the ball 3 times and everyone went home. It was pretty demoralizing. Again, I wrote about and talked about last week how Ron Rivera is on the hot seat. He is most likely going to get fired, but like it's so far gone here right now. I think the new owner, respected person in the football community, like Ron Rivera is, this is just a situation where everyone knows he's going to be fired. They already fired a defensive coordinator, Jack Del Rio. So it's like, let's just let the guy, you know, finish out this year, gracefully step down from his position, and then we go hire a new coach. And that's the way it's going to be. Whether it's Eric Bieniemy getting promoted from OC or they go out and get someone else, that's fine. I don't know what Bieniemy's contract situation is. I think he only might have signed a 2-year deal. So he might just be like, he might be out too. It's questionable there. But like, another instance, credit to the Dolphins. You beat who's on your schedule. Another instance of the Dolphins just absolutely wiping the floor with a bad team. The Dolphins play the Titans on Monday Night Football next week, which I hate that. That sounds horrible. Or no, they have their bye week maybe? Oh, no. Oh, I was so confused. I was just under the impression, because I knew the Packers and Giants played on Monday night next week, but there's a double Monday night game. One's on ABC and one's on ESPN. Packers, Giants, and Titans, Dolphins. Both of those matchups are disgusting. The way the Packers are playing, that's going to be a blowout. But yeah, I mean, there's not much to say here about the Dolphins and Commanders. It just is what it is. It's a game that I think everyone expect that to be. That was the last leg of my parlay was Dolphins minus 9.5. So Henry rushing yards, Henry touchdown, Dolphins 9.5, Falcons minus 2 with the profit boost from FanDuel. Shout out FanDuel, not a sponsor. I won like $120 on like a $10 parlay. It was great. And it was cruised too. I was like, I wasn't sweating it at all. Except at the end there, I thought maybe the Jets were going to pull some bullshit and cover against the Falcons with like a pick six turnover or something like that and win the game. But luckily that didn't happen. Bucks Panthers, gross divisional game. The Bucks win 21-18. I actually like the way Bryce looked in this game, but I'm gonna give this is the only factoid here that needs to be said about this game. Mike Evans is the fourth greatest Tampa Bay Buccaneer of all time. I would put him and now Jim. Fifth greatest Tampa Bay Buccaneer of all time. Top being in no, I'm not listing them in any particular order here, but Warren Sapp, Derek Brooks, John Lynch, Rondé Barber are probably more better Bucs than him, but fifth is arguably Mike Evans. He is now tied with Randy Moss for most consecutive years with 1,000 plus yards receiving. He broke it in this game against the Panthers. He has now gone 10 straight years, every single year of his career, with 1,000 yards receiving. It is quite the feat and something that is very, very underrated right now. And Mike Evans, also very, very underrated. He had a huge 75-yard touchdown score in this game. He is exceptional. He really, really, really is. He is the peak definition of consistency. And if he surpasses 1,000 yards next year, he will tie Jerry Rice for the most consecutive 1,000-yard seasons of all time. I would like to see Mike Evans break that. I think that is a record that is incredibly impressive and incredibly underappreciated. And I would like to see history. I would like to see Mike Evans break that record. Chances are he won't be on the Bucs next year. His contract is up. They did not get an extension, which he said. He's like, this is my deadline. If you don't give me an extension, then we're not talking. That's it to the end of the year. We can maybe revisit this in the offseason. And as cool as it would be for Mike Evans to break that record that Jerry Rice has and do it all for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I just don't know if that's going to happen based on like his career trajectory. He has won a Super Bowl, so it's like, you know, is he satisfied? You know, if he's satisfied with that and it's just like, I want to be a Buck now for the rest of my career, then kudos to you. Live out the twilight years, collect those 1,000 yards, and make your way into the record books and into Canton, Ohio, because you're going to be a Hall of Famer. And I mean, even if he doesn't, for whatever reason, let's just say he doesn't get 1,000 yards next year and he doesn't break the record, he's still a Hall of Famer. If he retires right now, he's a Hall of Famer, which is awesome. So Mike Evans, a great, great, great wide receiver, very underappreciated. Well, that was one of the afternoon games, the Panthers-Bucks. Other afternoon game, Rams-Browns. Rams win 36-19. Another instance of the Browns, they're just not able to maintain this level of play with no quarterback whatsoever. They're 7-5. The Rams now are 6-6, and very sneakily creeping up into the playoff picture with the Seahawks being 6-6 and really struggling. The Rams are rapidly approaching making a backdooring a wild card slot. So Matt Stafford looked good here, even without like Cooper Kupp didn't have a crazy good game. Puka Nacua left and came back again. He had four catches, 105 yards, and a touchdown. Kyren Williams is just an absolute weapon for the Rams. I mean, he's been really good for them. Matt Stafford, vintage Stafford, 22 of 37, 279 yards and three touchdowns. Joe Flacco, all things considered, for coming right off his couch and being inserted in this game, looked pretty good. I mean, he threw 23 of 44, 254 yards, two touchdowns, and an interception. But you're playing from behind all game. You're getting into a shootout now with the Rams. It just didn't work out, and it was a recipe for disaster. But I salute Joe Flacco for taking this task. And who knows, you know, maybe the rest of the season, get a little bit of practice underneath him, get a little bit more accommodated with the offense. Joe Flacco wins them a game or two, and they get into the playoffs. Who knows? But right now, the Browns are slipping, and you can't really blame them because it's just a tough go of it offensively. All right, well, here's the crown jewel of the afternoon. The Sunday slate was 49ers Eagles NFC championship game rematch. The 49ers, Debo Samuel, some other players there that have just been talking basically for an entire calendar year about how, you know, it was frustrating to lose to the Eagles because it was kind of bullshit. Their starting quarterback gets injured and then their backup quarterback gets injured. You're having like Christian McCaffrey run the wildcat. It devolved into kind of a laughing stock situation where it was just like the Niners were basically helpless on offense. They couldn't do anything. It was just a complete nightmare scenario for them. And, you know, they talked a lot over the last year about how if we had a quarterback, we would have beaten you. Like, no question, we would have beaten you. And they stomped in. They came into Philly. They had a horrible first quarter and somehow left it only down 6-0. They had multiple three and outs in the first quarter. The Eagles scored the ball twice, only limited to field goals by the defense, which was able to bend and not break in those scenarios. And then the offense got going. This is the scoring column. This is the box score. So Eagles outscore the Niners 6-0 in the first quarter. Then in every preceding quarter, the Niners outscore the Eagles 14-0, 14-7, 14-6. So 0 points in the fourth quarter, 42 in the next three. It is pretty impressive what they were able to do offensively against this Eagles team. And now this Eagles defense is definitely not what it was last year. Their secondary has been getting shredded basically all year. Like, they have been suspect at best in the secondary. But the Niners were just doing basically whatever they want. Debo had three touchdowns, so he was doing what he said. I mean, he was talking a lot, and he came in and was like, I'm going to dominate. He had two receiving touchdowns, one rushing touchdown, 22 yards on the ground and a touchdown, like I said, and 116 yards on four catches and two TDs in the air. Kittle had 68 yards. Ayuk was relatively quiet with only five catches, 46 yards, but he broke the seal on the scoring drought that the Niners had in that first quarter, where the Eagles seemed like they were on track to kind of dominate a little bit. Ayuk scored the first touchdown and opened the floodgates. Jawan Jennings had a great touchdown down the sidelines where he completely discarded an Eagles defender and ran in for a touchdown. Like, the Niners bullied the Eagles in every sense of the word. Their defensive line, their offensive line. I've said for a while now that the Niners have the best run blocking or the best blocking wide receivers, period, in the NFL. All of them, Ayuk, Jennings, Debo, they're all very physical. George Kittle, obviously, is a tight end, but he's a very, like, traditional tight end. Like, he blocks really well. He's really tough and he's a good receiver. So you have all these guys who block, because I remember talking this with my friends, like Ayuk was always talented, but he never got the run he's been getting over the past couple years because he didn't block. And now he blocks exceptionally well. So he's the number one wide receiver on that team. Even though Debo's great and he's a weapon, Ayuk is that dude. So everyone blocks. They're very physical in every aspect of the game. They run it down your throat. That's physical. Their wide receivers block. That's physical. And even yards after the catch, everyone on that field is dynamic yards after catch. It's insane. The defense, same thing. You got big, bad linebackers, which there was that incident on the sidelines. The head of security for the Eagles made contact with Dre Greenlaw. Then Dre Greenlaw made contact with him. There was a little bit of a scuffle. Things were broken up. Tempers flared. The Eagles lost their head of security. He was told to go back to the locker room. But the Niners lost their second best linebacker, which everyone thought, like, whoa, like, that's a huge momentum shifter for the Eagles. It wasn't. It turned out to not be a factor really at all, because the Niners defense still dominated even without Dre Greenlaw. So that was a whole bunch of nonsense that was going on, but you could tell that there were tempers there. When the Eagles did the push two times in a row to get a touchdown, there was a little bit of like a slight scuffle after that. You could tell that these teams don't like each other and that there's like some real animosity there. Now, the saving grace here of Eagles fans is just be like, we're still 10-2. We're still the top seed. Let's see what happens in the playoffs. That's the save, because it's a regular season game, right? Because regular season games mean nothing when you're that kind of team. That's what everyone is saying. Like, oh, let's see you in the playoffs. See you in the playoffs. Like, okay. If this team stays the same, you have to remember too, the Niners lost Hufanga for the year, which he's an amazing safety. If they're healthy, they're going to beat the brakes off everyone. I really do believe that. There's just, the Niners are very good. And this is like, you know, in Philly, rain, bad weather, hostile environment. You have a lot of pressure on you because you've been really talking that talk the entire time. Now it's time to walk the walk. They went in there and they walked the walk. They sprinted the walk. They beat the crap out of the Eagles, man. It wasn't even close. It wasn't close. After the first quarter, it wasn't close. So I really give a lot of credit to the Niners. You know, talk is cheap. And here you are, man. You cashed in. It was crazy. So the Eagles are 10-2. The Niners are 9-3. And that top spot in the NFC now is pretty wide open, because you have the Niners at 9-3, the Eagles at 10-2, the Lions are 9-3, and the Cowboys are 9-3. So any one of those teams can, in the last couple weeks here, they can make some serious moves to get that number one overall seed and that bye week. As for the AFC, actually, we'll do Monday Night Football first. What a shocker this was. Monday Night Football, Chiefs, Packers, the Chiefs going into Lambeau and losing convincingly 27-19. The Packers led this game every step of the way. They it was never really in doubt. I mean, they went into half up 14-6. And they outscored the Chiefs 7-6 in the third, and then the Chiefs outscored them 7-6 in the fourth, and they ended up winning. They win by 8 points. It was very impressive. And Jordan Love started off nice, struggled pretty heavily, and you can tell that like LaFleur and the offense itself wasn't really reliant on him. They didn't really want him throwing the ball until they absolutely had to in the second half. And it was always like play from behind. But now, over the past few weeks, the Packers seem to have really figured out what works for them and what works for Jordan Love. And it's working really well. Third straight win for the Packers. They're 6-6. And they are another team, like the Rams, now 6-6. A real chance to make the playoffs. And the Packers are probably going to end with 10 wins. The rest of their schedule is a hypothetical cakewalk. They play the Bucs at home, if it was in Tampa, I'd say, oh, maybe that might get a little chippy. But at home is a huge advantage for for Packers fans in December. So you have the Packers at home against the Bucs. Then they go to Carolina. Then they go to the Vikings. And then they finish up the season at home against the Bears. So at worst, oh, they play the Giants next week too. I skipped over that by accident. They play the Giants next week in New York on Monday Night Football. That's a win. So at worst, in your next five games, at worst you can go is 4-1. At worst. If they do a clean sweep, they end the season on a five-game winning streak and with 11 wins. And that would be pretty crazy considering where they were. So, Jordan Love, you know, he's been a roller coaster all year, but it finally looks like the Packers and Matt LaFleur figured out what works best for him and what he does best, and they're implementing that pretty successfully. I mean, they just beating the Chiefs Monday Night Football, like that's a big win. That's a huge win. And the Chiefs now are 8-3. They are the most susceptible I've ever seen them to actually losing football games. So right now, let's get into the standings now since we're talking about it. And that's the only thing I say about the Chiefs is like they look the most susceptible to losing I've ever seen them since Patrick Mahomes took over to be the starting quarterback. So you look at the standings right now. Miami actually has, it looks like the tiebreaker for whatever it is over Baltimore. They're both 9-3. So Miami 9-3, Baltimore 9-3. The Jags are up there now also at 8-3. Kansas City is 8-4. And they are the fourth seed. Pittsburgh 7-5. They're the fifth seed. Cleveland 7-5. They're the sixth seed. And then you have Indianapolis is the seventh seed currently at 7-5, but Houston obviously right there as well at 7-5. And then in contention, you have the Broncos and the Bills. And then after that, it's like the Bengals, the Chargers, the Raiders, Jets, Titans, and Patriots, which after Buffalo is really a 10-team playoff push right now. Anyone after Buffalo, like Cincy, Chargers, Vegas, they don't count. They're not going to make the playoffs. But Buffalo, Denver sitting at 6-6, Houston, Indianapolis, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh all at 7-5. And then the top of the AFC teams. For the NFC, it's a 10-team race in the AFC. It's a 9-team race in the NFC, because you have the Eagles at 10-2, the Niners and Detroit and Dallas at 9-3. Atlanta is going to be a division winner at 6-6. But also you have, after Atlanta, they're a division winner at 6-6, but they're also still kind of in the wild card hunt should they somehow lose the division. But look at the wild card teams are Minnesota at 6-6, Green Bay at 6-6, the Rams at 6-6, and Seattle at 6-6. So mathematically speaking, the Giants are in 12th right now at 4-8, but they're only 2 wins out of a playoff spot. That's not going to happen, but you have 5 teams. It's really in the NFC, unfortunately. It's the Eagles, the Niners, the Lions, and the Cowboys, and then kind of whoever else makes it. In my opinion, I think those are the last 4 teams that are like, those are the divisional games, is going to be some combination, however it ends up shaking up, because the Cowboys now have a real shot because they play the Eagles still. So they have a real shot to win the division still. They actually play next week. Wow, good thing I checked the schedule. They actually play next week on Sunday Night Football. So the winner, if the Dallas Cowboys can beat the Eagles next week on Sunday night, they, I think, would have first place, or at least they'd be tied for now. And then, you know, we'll see what happens the rest of the year. But it's close. It's down to the wire here for these teams. But it's really those 4 teams are going to be like any combination of playing each other, depending on seeding. And then everyone else is just like kind of mediocre, really mediocre, actually. So yeah, it is a crazy playoff hunt right now. The NFC and the AFC are both tight for different reasons. Obviously, I would say the AFC is definitely the better conference because you have two teams at 6-6 there battling for like the last wildcard spot, and then five teams battling for different seeding in the NFC at 6-6. But it is very competitive. It's very thick. The Monday night game tonight, I'm recording on Monday, of course, like I always do. The Monday night game is Bengals-Jaguars. Would have been phenomenal if Burrow was playing in this game. However, he is not. The Jags are at home. They're 10-point favorites. Going to be streaming this game. I don't think I'll be watching this game. Well, I mean, I'll be streaming this game while I'm doing other stuff. I don't know if I'm going to have this. This game's going to have my full undivided attention. Maybe I'll throw a bet on it. I had a great weekend betting, so maybe I'll throw that. I did. So my gambling record this week was flawless. It was Chargers -4.5. They win 6-0. I mentioned my parlay. Derrick Henry rushing, touchdown, Dolphins to cover, Falcons to cover, that hit. And then the afternoon slate, I just parlayed Niners money line and McCaffrey anytime touchdown, and that hit as well. So a good day at the track, as they say. But that'll do it for this episode from my point of view. I have a nice week of movies coming up. I'm going to see Napoleon, which I heard good and not good things about it, in terms of like historical accuracy and really representing like what Napoleon meant for like warfare. It's really kind of minimized to just like giant battle after giant battle. Those are negatives that I heard, but on the other hand, it's like pretty solid, and also wacky pacing I heard is a problem. It is 2.5 hours. So, but obviously the visuals, the practical effects, cinematography, all that kind of stuff with Ridley Scott is A+ from what I heard. So we'll see, maybe hot and cold on this movie. I'm going to give it a whirl and I'll report back next week. And then also on Wednesday, I'm going to see Godzilla -1, which I am so excited about and has gotten such good reviews. Really looks like a traditional old school Godzilla movie with modern effects, in terms of like Godzilla is created, he emerges and he destroys Japan. Like, that is Godzilla in a nutshell. If you were just to describe Godzilla, it's like, yeah, he's a giant lizard monster that destroys Japan. That looks like what this movie is about, and more though. I'm very excited for it. So I'm going Wednesday night to see that. So I'll report back next week with how those movies were. Nothing crazy in terms of reviews, but I think there are some movies rolling out now that I'm actually going to be able to go see. So excited about that. So that'll do it for this episode from my point of view. Thank you all very much for listening. I appreciate you as always. Have a great rest of your week, and I'll talk to you all next Tuesday.